From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. One of the blogs that we work with here at Scared Monkeys, of course, is Blink on Crime. You know, the website at blinkoncrime.com. Blink is here to talk about a new case, and I'm always amazed and impressed with the good work that they do over there. And the Christine Shetty case is one that has several parts to it. There's a YouTube video. And it's an important case that the mainstream media, for some reason, isn't picking up. But, of course, our friend Blink has. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Tell us about Christine Shetty.
Well, you know, Dana, this is one of these cases that, you know, they all pull at your heartstrings, but there's so many facets to it. She was a 26-year-old woman, a mother of three, and what I would characterize as an abusive long-term relationship. You know, the old story of the guy that's always going to change and it's always going to get better. And young woman that, you know, had two very small children and, you know, not a lot of options. And it's horrible to see, but how this particular one, this particular woman was really victimized by the, I'll call him a gentleman, that she was, had two children with. But it, not just that, it is a woman that, in our opinion, having, you know, spent significant amount of time and research on this case, that we believe was victimized when she went missing on November 13th, 2007, out of a town called Pocomoke City, which is in Maryland, just across the border, really, from Delaware.
Now, this, you know, I'm just looking at the story, and I've read it over and watched the YouTube video, and again, I commend you for the good work that you've done. This character, Levi, I think you're being very polite by saying gentleman. let's talk about him a bit.
That is the boy's father, Zeke and Isaac. And when I say father, I'm again being polite because he spent very little time with him. He gave her absolutely no financial or any other kind of support for these adorable little guys. Didn't really keep a job. And I've had exclusive access to Christine's personal accounts and emails and MySpace, which her mother, Lynn Dodenhoff, entrusted me, which in itself is amazing. If you look at the contrast between Lynn and, I hate to say it, but Cindy Anthony, instead of Cindy's approach, which was, no, my child never did anything wrong, she was perfect, and, you know, it's somebody else, Lynn came to me and said, and I'll never forget it, we've grown pretty close, and she said, you know, she made a lot. She had a self-esteem issue. She probably made some bad choices. But let me tell you this. She loved those children more than anything in the world.
Yeah.
And she loved Levi. And in one way or another, that ended up taking her life. She never would have left those children. And that's what it's really about. She has three children that were told that their mother left them. And as you can see on our site, I just can't think of anything cooler for a child to have to grow up like that.
Yeah, exactly. And the big difference between Anthony in this case is someone is wanting answers now and will, you know, accept the facts as they come forward. Why wouldn't the media pick up on this story? It's fascinating.
I think there's a few reasons. A couple of them are there. The underbelly, if you will, in this community that was the fringe that Christine had been introduced to by Levi, also through Levi's cousin Steve Hall, who he had lived with on and on. When I say they're a mess, I mean they're all felons. They've all got, in that jurisdiction, what's called peace orders, the equivalent of a restraining order.
Right.
They've all got, you know, babies. One gentleman has seven or eight children, I think, with somebody. Nobody's got a steady job. And I don't believe, and as I said, I've had exclusive access, I don't believe Christine ever knew that about about any of these people. I think Levi introduced her to this group, guy by the name of, his name is Clarence Jackson, nickname is Junior, and his girlfriend, Tia Johnson, lived in this farmhouse. It's got about 67 acres on it. These people were unwanted themselves in that community. They, their first order of business when they got down there was they ripped the tin off of this chicken farm, these chicken houses, and burned the chicken houses to the ground. They stole a laptop and cell phone from the neighbor, of which Junior was arrested for. They were in the property from about September 2007 till a week after Christine went missing, and it was truly, truly hell for the neighbors that were living near them, so much so that they actually ended up getting a security guard at night and a security camera, which was motion activated. So on a positive note, we can say unequivocally who was at that property, who came and left the evening of November 12th and the day, the following day of November 13th, which are the dates in question.
But
and to your question about why the mainstream media didn't cover it, I just think it was so sad. And you know, right away, one of the radio stations, which had a blog, WGMD, that was covering it locally, nobody knew this, but the mother of Levi Hall, Joyce Hall, was an employee.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Exactly. So, and nobody knew that until Lynn Dodenhoff, Christine's mom, did a radio interview and mentioned her by name. So imagine, you know, imagine that follow-up meeting in HR.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that there was a lot of belief on behalf of law enforcement. The mayor and lead detective at the time did not believe that Christine went missing from suspicious means or foul play. He believed one of three stories that this Junior Jackson said, they had come back from picking up their children, and Christine was gone. She left her two kids there,
yeah.
her clothing. I mean, she didn't leave with anything, and that was the story that was believed.
Yeah, well, that sounds crazy to me. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Christine and Levi. How did she meet him?
She actually met him through his brother, Stan,
uh-huh.
who is another character. He actually was convicted of beating up an 80-year-old woman while stealing her purse in the Rehoboth area. And they were, I believe, a little bit of what I'll call tween friends, maybe 1450, had dated maybe once or twice, but nothing certainly serious. It was just friendly, and that's how she ended up meeting Levi. And from there, they were inseparable. When I say inseparable, I mean not necessarily in proximity, because there were, you know, occasions where they would, you know, be apart for a while. But as I said, as I'm going through and I'm looking at her, you know, her personal correspondence and email, she was a victim. She loved him in the purest of ways, in the most naive of ways. But as I read this information and as I see this individual, it's almost in a predatory way.
Right.
And if you've ever interviewed anybody that's a victim of abuse, which I know you have, mm-hmm. in these situations, these guys are phenomenal at it. They have a pattern. You know, it's abuse, and then there's like a honeymoon period after that where, you know, you get this individual back into the swing of thinking, well, maybe they could change. You know, maybe it was a one-time making them needy, if you will. And I'm seeing this in black and white in her background, and it is heartbreaking. I don't think I'll ever understand why sometimes that happens, because it hasn't happened to me personally, although I can say there's a lot of women that it does happen to. But it would be really great if in all of this, maybe we can break that cycle by conveying, you know, educating and conveying these messages.
Well, the cycle of violence is something that's been going on.
They don't change. They're not, yeah. You know, the reality is, in general, if a man hits you or beats you or, you know, verbally abuses you, it's not going to get better.
No. No, it doesn't, and it takes a lot for it to even get under control. It never does get better. You're right. Blink is here from Blink on Crime. We're talking about the Christine Shetty case. I want to get into law enforcement a little bit more, the investigation itself. You know, Investigation 101, and it doesn't take an expert to figure out people don't usually walk away from all their clothes, all their children, and just, you know, disappear to go find another life. Think of Drew Peterson and his one of his wives that just disappeared. You know, it doesn't take an expert to figure out something is wrong there. What's with law enforcement? I know you said that they bought into a story, but there has to be more than that. What did they do? What didn't they do?
Right. In fairness, Christine was I don't want to say in somewhat of a despair, but she was. She was again in this cycle with Levi. She had been back at home living with her parents and her children. And from what I can tell, he pretty much enticed her with some type of plan, which we're not sure what it is, but it had to do with this particular farmhouse property. So she had an argument with her mom, which if you've known living with your, I don't know personally, but if you're a mom and living with your mom, I can imagine that's probably not the easiest situation. And Levi had beat her.
Yeah.
Levi had beat her about a month before she went missing very badly, and she was, you know, talking to him again in a friendly way, and I'm certain that that was very disturbing for her parents. So I believe they bought in because of that, because she did leave her mom's house and said, you know, I'm leaving. So
right.
There was a little bit of that. However, there have been four different detectives on this case. They had a deputy assigned for the whole first week, where you know and I know, in a missing persons case, you treat that property like a crime scene and work backwards.
Right.
And that didn't happen. I've heard a couple of different versions about forensics, but I've been there. And if you're performing forensics on a, for instance, rug that was removed from the house, it's not going to be in the garage.
No.
2 years later, you know, where you can actually drive a car on it. A colleague of mine that has been on several searches on that property went out there, and to this day we're, you know, finding things that may or may not be pertinent. They found a piece of her clothing just this past May. One of the most disturbing things that bothered me was there was portions of a skull that washed up on Azateque Island, which is very close to this. Oh, I would say very close enough that it would be worth taking a look. And Lynn got this information. She went to the detective in that jurisdiction and with Christine's information. And unfortunately, the detectives in Pocomoke had not even input Christine's information and dental records into NCIC.
Oh, geez.
Which was shocking. I mean, it had been filled out a year and a half, or, you know, right away. It wasn't even in the database.
Is this a small police department, one that's not used to this type of investigation?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It is a small police department. No, they're not what I would call skilled in high-profile investigations or missing persons investigations. This is a highly rural area.
Yeah, okay. Well, that doesn't excuse it, but it does explain it a little bit.
Right. It doesn't excuse it. It does explain it. But, you know, I've always been of the opinion that if something that you're doing isn't working, try something else.
Yeah, or ask for help. You know, that's...
Exactly. Ask for help. And one of the issues is the lead detective, Alex Kagan, actually put out a warrant for Christine for child abandonment. And when I saw that, I nearly fell over.
Oh,
I called Lynn and I said, well, what is this about? And she said, well, I was told that he put that warrant out there because, God forbid, you know, if she is alive and she does surface,
yeah,
then if she's arrested for something, then they'll put her on a hold.
A way to pick her up, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But if she's in the data, if she's in any missing persons database, that would have been done automatically.
Yeah. No, exactly.
There is no reason that I'm aware of in that jurisdiction, having researched it, that that makes any sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense, and there's other ways to make sure that people get picked up if they're missing. I want to get into the cast of characters here, and believe me, there's a cast of characters. I love the pictures.
Yeah.
Dominic and Aaron, let's talk about them.
Dominic and Aaron von Grovenitz. Dominic is about 5'5". His wife, well, soon-to-be ex-wife, is about 6'1". They've got, between the two of them, 8 kids, I believe.
Jeez.
Dominic was one of the most vocal people who professed he was not there.
Mm-hmm.
He has been on several blogs with different versions and storylines, and none of them make sense. He was there on the 13th. There's no indicating car coming or going on the 12th or 13th that he arrived or left, so I will say that. However, on the 13th, he was standing on the roof with Junior at about 1 p.m., and so, as I say, there was no comings or goings, so he had to be there. And he was standing on the roof with Junior because on the 9th of November, there was a flue fire at the property, which burned a hole in the roof. And so they were patching that. And at this time, as I mentioned earlier on, there was a significant feud going with the neighbors. So this neighbor was watching them like a hawk. Not only did they have surveillance, but the comings and goings could tell you who was who, etc. So she's identified him as being there on the 13th without question.
Right.
So my question would be, why would you lie?
Exactly.
And then you have and his wife Erin was not there at the gathering. Mm-hmm. by all accounts. And that was also one of the things that I was told, was that one of the initial deputies said, well, to tell you the truth, there's really no crime scene, so we can't call it a missing persons case. There's no indication of foul play. We can't even prove Christine was here. And my question was, well, how did her kids get here, A? And B, you just took witness statements from 6 other people that said she was here.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it's a mixed-up department that maybe, you know, I hate to say that because I'm a huge supporter of law enforcement that just doesn't have the experience when it comes to these sorts of investigations. Has anybody offered or has anybody been asked to take a polygraph?
They have all been asked to take, excuse me, not all, let me, Levi, Junior, and Tia Johnson have been asked to take polygraphs that I'm aware of. I can confirm that. I'm not sure about some of the other characters, but they have declined. After the, just to get into some of the really sketchy tie-downs, I guess, if you will, Christine's best friend is a guy by the name of Jimmy Quayle. She called him Q. The night of the 12th, right around 9:30 p.m., she called Q, and he was talking to her. And he said that she was trying to whisper something to him. And I said to Q, when I interviewed him, I said, did you have any indication of what it was? Was she scared? He said she wasn't scared, but she would go. I could tell there was a very noisy background. She would go, like, almost like you're going to try to get away from the crowd. And then she would try to whisper something. He couldn't hear her. And then it was almost like the crowd then came to her again. The noise would amp back up. He very much got the impression she was trying to find some privacy to speak to him.
Right.
He said, do you want me to come get you? And she said, no, it's cool. It's cool. Levi's coming. Now, the important distinction about that is there was no plans for Levi to come get her. I've seen on his MySpace and her MySpace after she was missing, where he indicates he's sorry he didn't listen. She's, you know, something to the effect of, I'm sorry I should have came and got you when you said you hated it there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Q tried to call her back that evening. I want to say around 11 o'clock. He didn't get her. 11 a.m. on the 13th, the next morning, he called, and she was using Junior's cell phone, by the way. She didn't have one of her own. Junior answers the phone to Q, and he says, I don't have a lot of cell minutes. I'm out. I'm not at the house. When I get back, I'll tell Christine to call you. So we already know from surveillance he was at the house.
Mm-hmm.
He never left that house until about, I want to say, 3 o'clock. Or, I'm sorry, yes, I'm right, around 2:38 or something to that effect. So, again, why lie?
Yeah, exactly.
It gave them an entire day to stave off calling anyone. They also told Lynn, Christine's mother, that they filed a police report. And that they told them they had to wait for 24 hours, you know, that old line.
Mm-hmm.
None of that was true. Lynn was the one that filed the police report the next day. Levi and his mother came and picked up the kids on the evening of the 13th. The next day, he filed for full custody. If you're not sure if somebody's missing or not,
wow.
If you haven't seen your children, really, to speak of, in 3 or 4 months,
yeah,
and spend any time with them, why are you filing for full custody?
Exactly. Exactly. There's more red flags in this case than there is. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, and I got to tell you, Dana, I was out. I saw pictures before I went out on location. It didn't even prepare me for what a hole. And I don't mean any disrespect to the property owner. I'm just saying, in terms of a young woman to meet her end, and in our opinion, still be out there.
Yeah.
It is vile. I mean, the complete lack of dignity shown to her amongst this, you know, riffraff, if you will. I feel really old. I just said that. But it really pulls at you. And I was told before I got out there, there was almost like a vibe. You know what I mean?
When you're
done, and there was.
Yeah. Oh, sure. You get a gut feeling as soon as you start looking at something or you walk onto a property. I get it. We only got about a minute left here, Blink. I appreciate you coming on. What's law enforcement doing now? Are they just sitting on their hands?
No. There has been some progress in the case. There was an arrest of a peripheral person who has told law enforcement that Christine is on that property, has given a story that Christine was beaten and then hit with a shovel and buried.
Gee.
Now, I can't confirm that that's actually what happened, but I can say that after that, there was a car that was pulled out of the river there, which you know and I know, they don't just find a car.
No.
So there is some motion. We're very hopeful that the work that we're going to do is going to bring to light some of these really important, information and progress the case, because we're not going to let it go away. We're not. We're also going to be announcing another search on the property with state-of-the-art equipment, ground-penetrating radar. We've also we're looking into satellite imagery. We're also looking into some other high-tech variations of search and rescue equipment that have not been used.
Any timetable on that?
Yes, I would say before October.
Okay, great. No, that's fantastic. Listen, we're out of time. The webpage is blinkoncrime.com. You can also click through the links on the show notes. Blink, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dana.
We'll talk more. Keep me informed about what's going on.
Always. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye. Okay, that's Blink from Blink on Crime. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back with author Diane Fanning. She has two new books coming out. One's A Poison Passion, and one's called Mummy's Little Girl. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, where we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. My next guest has a couple of new books coming out. You can go to her webpage by going to www.dianefanning.com. Just click on the link in the show notes. One of the books is A Poison Passion, the true story of a young mother, her war hero husband, and the marriage that ended in murder. It's a fascinating book. And the next one, Mummy's Little Girl, about Casey Anthony and her daughter Kaylee's tragic fate. It's always nice to have Diane on with me. Hi, Diane. How are you?
Hi, Dana. It's great to be with you tonight.
You're a busy lady.
Well, it's not like I wrote them quite that close together, but that's just the way the publishing things fall out.
Well, they come up, but it seems like any time that I've talked to you or emailed or had you on the show, you're always working on a case and a story, I should say. And I've watched the YouTube video. I've looked at some of the preview stuff, and it's September 1st, I believe, Poison Passion's coming out. Tell us about that.
A Poison Passion is about this guy named Michael Severance, who'd been raised in Maine and went into the Air Force. He was stationed out in West Texas, and he worked as a C-130 work crew manager. So he had the team that did the work on the C-130 outside of the cockpit he was in charge of.
Right.
He's a great guy. He survived 5 tours of duty to the Middle East, and then he met Wendy Davidson. And he married that woman and didn't survive 5 months of marriage.
Yeah, that's wild, you know. And that alone is a great premise for the book. Let's talk about the relationship, his wife and him, and how they met, and how he eventually met his Waterloo.
Well, he basically picked her up at a bar, and she got pregnant. And he really thought that it was important for a child to have a father in its life. And so he decided that even though he hadn't been romantically involved with her except for that one night, that he wanted to do the right thing and marry her. And that's just what he did. They actually did not get married till a week and a half after the baby was born. But they did get married, and she also had another child that was 3 years old from the first marriage. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, his in-laws, particularly his mother-in-law, despised him. And every single day, she told her daughter how much she hated her new son-in-law. And she always found fault with him and never saw anything good about him. The poor guy, in order to not disrupt his wife's life, was traveling 90 miles each way to go to work and so that they could live in San Angelo. And he was doing everything he could and helping with the kids when he could and helping her with her veterinary practice when he could. But like it was almost like water torture. The mother kept drilling into her daughter, Wendy, that, you know, this guy's no good. Nothing good about him. And in the end, when there was a trip planned for Maine, the mother-in-law convinced his wife that when you go to Maine, they're either not going to let you come back or they're not going to let your son come back. And they're going to stay forever, he would stay forever in Maine. And there was nothing further from the truth, but apparently she bought into it. And there was also the little attraction of his life insurance package. So one night, he'd been doing a little drinking. He'd just gotten back from a special training school, and they were getting ready to go to Maine, and he was all excited that his family was going to meet his wife and his little boy. And she gave him another beer when he came in the house and slipped some pills into it that made him unconscious. And then she took a needle filled with euthanasia, and rammed it into his chest and killed him.
Now, Wendy, a veterinarian, correct?
Correct.
And yeah, I love the YouTube video. She couldn't have the heart to euthanize a cat or a dog as a vet. It was so difficult for her, yet she was able to do something like this. Well, you know, without giving away the whole story, we want people to buy the book. What drove her to this?
You know, it's just so inexplicable because she lost a couple veterinary jobs at other clinics because she was told to euthanize animals that she then secreted out of the place and found them homes. And she was, you know, really, really very protective of animals. And yet people just seemed not as important, I guess. And she demonstrated that indifference to people one time when she wanted to get her father into a ugly conversation that she could put on tape, and she used her 3-year-old son as a backdrop for it. So she subjected the little boy to that just to get what she wanted. Now there are those she's serving time in Texas prison for murdering her husband. There are some people who don't think the right person is in jail, and most of those point the finger at the mother-in-law.
Oh, really?
And they say she's the one who did it. And even Wendy's step-grandfather thinks that the mother-in-law did it.
Wow. Diane Fanning's here. She's the author of the new book, A Poison Passion, coming out September 1st. You know, we have mother-in-laws, we have insurance policies and vet drugs, obviously, is what did this guy in. Was there another guy involved?
No, there was not. She tended to be pretty serious to her in her serial relationships. She didn't seem to fool around on any of the men in her life, no matter how tenuous the relationship she had with him. She did seem to always be reaching out to love in all the wrong places, and she had some disastrous relationships. But Michael was the good guy. She finally did land somebody that was good, and she blew it big time.
Yeah, and her mother drove her to it, or maybe the mother did it. Is there any evidence that points to the mother?
No, in fact, there's a lot that points away from her. And, you know, that no one in law enforcement thinks that the mother did it. I mean, there was this suspicion at one point that someone has had to help her move the body, but then they got a police officer, a woman police officer out there the same size that she was, and recreated the whole crime and the moving of the body, and the police officer, who was a little smaller actually than Wendy, didn't have any problem at all.
Okay, so it looks like it's it's a fascinating case. Someone who's been to Afghanistan and Iraq, and when he finally finds someone that he falls in love with, she ends up sticking a needle in his chest. How bizarre is that?
You can't even imagine it. And plus, it's a professional woman. It's not like he picked up some trashy woman on the side of the road and, you know, hoped for the best. I mean, he married a professional woman, and you expect so much more from anyone that is in what is really a position of trust. I know some people that are probably more picky about their veterinarians than they are about their own physicians.
Exactly.
So it was just, and the whole story unfolded, and part of the story was the town itself, San Angelo. It literally is in the middle of nowhere. It's a fairly decent-sized city, I think a population about 70,000, but it's kind of cut off from the rest of the world, and you make one wrong turn out there in the middle of nowhere, and you'll just keep riding forever without seeing anybody, and hardly any houses at all. I mean, it's just, it is really vast and open wildness out there. And in a way, that makes everybody there kind of insular. But what it creates is an environment where it is easier to isolate. If someone wants to control another individual, it is easier to isolate them and cut them off from the rest of the world in that environment, because the environment's giving you a helping hand with that. And Wendy comes from a family that has never set foot out of the state of Texas and just doesn't understand why anybody would set foot out of the state of Texas, which is kind of spooky.
Is it ever?
So, you know, it's it was just a very bizarre case, and I have a lot of letters and documents that I went through for this, had some audio tapes that were extremely strange, transcripts of telephone conversations when she was in prison. So I've got a pretty intimate look at her and her family, and it's a little bit scary.
Yeah, you just don't know who's out there, that's for sure. Let's get into another book of yours coming out November 3rd. It's, of course, Mommy's Little Girl, the Casey Anthony, Kaylee Anthony story. I saw Nancy Grace on I think it was the O'Reilly Show the other day, and they were talking about how she covered that story 206 times. It was amazing. And you know what? The story is far from over, but it's certainly something that you've written about. Tell us, if you can, about Mommy's Little Girl.
Well, Dana, it's a very different kind of case for me to have written about.
Yeah.
Normally, the amount of documentation that's been made available is stuff you don't even see till during trial or maybe even after trial.
Exactly.
But there was definitely, just on documents alone, enough to fill a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what is in there is so compelling and points such a clear finger of guilt. The other thing is that you go and start talking to people, and there were a lot of people I could not talk to because it seems like every time I turned around, someone had a PR person or an attorney or something. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything like it since the Lisa Nowak case. And I don't know if it has anything to do with being in Orlando or if it just was coincidence, but it has been difficult getting to people. But I did get through to some people. I did get some anecdotes that haven't ever been in the media. And I have also been following, since I finished the manuscript in May, I've been following all the new stuff that's been released, looking to see if there's anything new that I wasn't aware of before I finish the manuscript, so that I can amend the current manuscript should something arise.
Well, you know, I think that we're far from over when it comes to this case. A lot will come out in trial that we haven't heard of. But, you know, as an author, Diane, you said it best. There has been a lot that has come out in a case like this. You just don't see that happening.
No, you don't. And, you know, the one thing is, like, there isn't a trial yet, but publishers, you know, they sort of set up this little train in motion, and they have certain expectations. And originally the trial was set for last January, and then it was moved to March, and then it was moved to October. So a publisher's not going to wait on that train to leave the station. And so you just move forward and you do what you can. In this case, it was easy to find all the material that was needed. And it's also possible, like with one of my books, that I did an update later to the book, and there was a new edition release. So I imagine after the trial, if there's compelling evidence there, it certainly would be a possibility to do that as well.
That book, Mommy's Little Girl, will be available November 3rd. And, of course, the website, DianeFanning.com. Click on the link on the show notes. Let's play a game here. I'm going to give you a name in the Anthony case, and I want you to say one word that describes the person. You up to that?
I'll do my best.
Casey Anthony.
Narcissistic.
Cindy Anthony.
Denial.
George Anthony.
Sad.
Exactly. Lee Anthony.
Peculiar.
Leonard Padilla.
Odd.
Is he one of the guys with the PR person?
Yeah.
We won't go into that any further. You know, and it's so sad because there's really only one victim in this case, and it's that poor little girl, Kaylee Anthony. And
that's why I dedicated my book to her, and she's really the most important one of all.
You know, Tim Miller from Texas Ex Research said it best. So many people, so many personalities involved in this case, all looking for 15 minutes of fame, including family members, including Casey Anthony herself, but what was forgotten, and even somewhat in the media, not so much by Nancy Grace, though I do give her credit for her coverage, is that little girl, and it's just amazing. Anyway, the books are Mommy's Little Girl and A Poison Passion, DianeFanning.com. Thank you, Diane.
You mentioned Tim, but you didn't ask for a word, and if you asked me for a word for Tim Miller, I would say hero.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye. That's author Diane Fanning. And, again, check out the books. Buy them. They look like they'll be great. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back with Robin Sachs with her weekly segment, Nothing But the Sachs. And she has a special guest that she's going to bring on with her. Of course, you know Diane Diamond as a long-time media person, crime reporter, currently working on the Michael Jackson case. You see a lot of her work on Entertainment Tonight. Diane Diamond and Robin Sachs will join me here in just a few minutes on the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll take a quick break and be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Robin Sachs segment that we call Nothing But the Sachs, and a special treat to have Diane Diamond along with her. I was looking at a link on the Huffington Post of an article that Robin Sachs wrote, and she's got everybody all fired up again, about an article that in The Economist magazine, Do Sex Crimes Victims Justice, and Robin makes sense, and there's a lot of nuts out there that are stirring up trouble. Well, that's okay. That's what we're here to talk about. Diane and Robin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Hey, this is a treat to have you both on. Robin, I want to start with you a little bit. What's with this article on the Huffington Post? You're making sense. You read an article. You talk about it, but there's some people that are responding actually quite bizarrely, I think.
Yeah, people are pissed off on the Huffington Post. Let me tell you, wow! It's fascinating when you actually really start to put your finger on the pulse of what's going on through the country through the comments from the folks that are out there. And I wrote an article responding to an article that was just recently posted and printed in the print edition of The Economist on this last August 6th, which was talking about whether or not the sex crimes laws are unjust. And the article, which I thought that I gave the benefit of pondering, thinking, and fleshing out, took me a few days to respond to, talked about the unfairness of the laws towards defendants. And I thought to myself when I read that article, you know, our system is very much in favor of giving the benefit of the doubt to the defendant, and I understand how that works, but how often do the laws end up being unjust for the victim? And so that was the angle I took. And apparently, the Huffington Post has a lot of people who are pro-pedophile rights, pro-registry rights, and I understand. And you know what? The one thing I did find out, though, is that, and I don't try to hide this, is I wrote this from my perspective and my opinion, and certainly there were a lot of people who responded from their perspective and their opinion.
Yeah, you know, Diane Diamond, someone who's covered crime and stories like this for many, many years. It's strange to see how the people think sometimes. We're all law and order. We're pro law and order. I'm a if you do the crime, you do the time kind of guy. But there are a lot of people out there that think that the court system is just unjust and too harsh. It's very bizarre.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'll take a little bit of a contrarian viewpoint here because I am in the same realm as you. Crime, justice, you don't do the crime if you don't want to do the time. But I will tell you that I have written columns about, I have a syndicated column, and I have written about this in the past, that many people, mostly men, I'll be honest with you, have contacted me and said, you know what, my ex-wife was a you-know-what-rhymes-with-witch, and accused me of terrible things, and I got convicted of something I never did to my kids, and now all of a sudden I have to register on a registry, and my life is turned upside down.
Yep.
I can't live where I want. I can't get a job. I can't, all because my ex-wife wanted to get back at me. Conversely, I had the mother of a 17-year-old who had just turned 18, who had a sexual liaison with his 16-year-old girlfriend. That was considered child abuse, child molestation, and this young man at 18 years old was put on a sex registry, when in fact it was just a boyfriend-girlfriend thing. So I do think, and you know, Robin is my hero as a prosecutor all these years, but I do think that we could refine those laws a little bit. Some of the people on the registries might not belong there.
Robin, do we need to relook at the sex offender registry? You know, Diane makes a good point.
Absolutely, and I do agree with that point. I do think that it is very important for the registry to be something, a tool that has the great importance and great meaning.
Absolutely.
And so in order to qualify to be on that list, you want to have an immediate idea of who you're dealing with the people on the list. You don't want to have to wonder, okay, is the person that's on this list, is this someone who was 18, who had a 16-year-old girlfriend, and the parent couldn't control them, and so they ended up pleading to some sex crime? So and it dilutes the list when you put people that aren't in our traditional mindset of using their power, authority, or duress, influence, force, violence, any of those things to commit a sex crime or based on the very young age of a child. So I do agree that there needs to be some reform in terms of how we look at the list. But the list is not the only aspect of the prosecution and or conviction and the crime. And I think that what happens is sex crimes have become synonymous with sex offender registry list, which is not really the essence of what's really going on out there. The crime needs to be delineated from the list, and then the list needs to be dealt with as the list.
And there's a lot of people that aren't on the list that should be on the list.
Yeah.
Probably more than are
actually on there.
Well, you know, when you look and you go on some of these websites and you can, I know I did it where my daughter lives, and you click on a link and it shows you how many registered sex offenders are living in the area, and all of a sudden
it's the same thing, Dana. I went right to where my daughter lives with my three grandchildren.
Yep.
And I was appalled.
Scares the hell out of you is what it does. And,
yeah.
And I wonder, Diane Diamond, is there a balancing act? How do we do this? We talk about re-victimization on the show quite a bit. To the true victim, one that gets put through the ringer, not only in court but through the system, and then again and again and again, and then on a blog site even like Huffington Post, who we know leans to the left so far that it will tip us all over onto our heads. How do we balance that?
Well, you know, it's just vigilance, I think. You know, I have a house in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I looked up, just out of curiosity, because my grandkids were coming to visit, the sex registry people in that area, and there was a 58-year-old woman who looked like, you know, if you were standing next to her in the grocery store, you would say, "Excuse me, I forgot one item. Could you please watch my kids and let me go to the back?"
Yeah.
And she was on the sex registry.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's the parents being aware, and the only way to stop it, I guess, is to stop the victimization of the children in the first place.
Yeah.
But once they have been victimized, then they go into the court system, and it's not a pretty sight sometimes, but if it's handled in the right way, and Robin can speak to this too, the parents, the court officers, the judges can say to the children, "This is your chance to fight back," and make it a positive rather than a negative event in their life.
And that's so important, Robin Sachs. And to, you know, let's get away from the article a little bit, because I think it's very clear, and you just have to go to the Huffington Post to read it and see the responses. But I want to get in now more into the media coverage of course, we've seen Diane and Entertainment Tonight covering Michael Jackson. That started to slow down a little bit now. Now the coroner's decided to seal the autopsy results. The media seems to be sitting back now on its hands waiting for the next thing. Geraldo keeps going over it and over it and over it. But is this story now over? Obviously, there's a much bigger picture when it comes to Michael Jackson, right down from doctor shopping to prescription drug usage to enabling to whatever. What's next for the media?
I don't think that the story is over about Michael Jackson. I think it's taking a breather, you know. I think we're all waiting on pins and needles for the toxicology report, the full autopsy report. But I agree with you. I think that there are going to be issues stemming out of it for a long, long time. Body dysmorphic disorder, cosmetic surgery, anorexia, celebrity worship. Why do we worship these people that really, when you look at their personal lives, are anything but idols when you really look at them? And so I hope it's a teaching moment. I know that sounds corny, but I really think it's a good time for us to stop and take stock of what it is that we think is so glamorous and fabulous, and, you know, the idols that we put up on the pedestals. When you really look at Michael Jackson's life, it wasn't really something to be applauded, I don't think.
No,
and was he talented? Of course he was. He
sure
was great showman. But as a human being, as with all of us, there were dark sides, and no one's really talking about that.
Robin, how do we teach the people?
Well, you know, from me, that I've preached this many, many times, that there are various forms and avenues by which we can learn and gain information about today's most important topics. And for good or bad, better, worse, and everything in between, the media is an unbelievably powerful source in terms of reaching the masses. The goal is to have good people out there, like Diane, like yourself, who are out there giving out factual information about what's going on with expert opinions and something to foster good banter and good discussion to be able to see where we're headed. That's the first step in terms of educating and looking at the media as an avenue for kind of keeping our pulse on what's going on. And then from there, you hope that people take the information that they learn and then apply them, make changes from them, blog about them, talk about them, write about them, and then implement them in terms of their lives.
And you know what? Put them in perspective. I think that's what the media today is really lacking. Everything is a minute long. You know, we try to tell a really complicated story, and we have a minute 10 to tell it in. That's why shows like yours, Dana, are so important, because you give people time to really talk about it and think about it and chew on it, you know? We're a fast food nation, that's for sure, and we're getting our news that way too, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Ladies, thank you.
Thank you so much. We will be back with you soon.
And have a great weekend.
Okay, you too. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs and Diane Diamond with the weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, and we'll see you next week here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.